Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 10, delivered on September 21, 2017. The title of this lecture is Applications of Annuities and Perpetuities.
Today, Applications of Annuities and Perpetuities. Before I do that, I want to back just a couple of lectures up, show you an example, and actually ask you a question. In recent years, there's been a proliferation of these quick loan places where you can write a check and they'll cash it 2 weeks later or a month later, and you've got some money up front, and then you pay interest and all of that. I want to show you a quick example of that and how you can apply some of the principles we have already covered in the class. You sort of run into some financial difficulties. It's 2 weeks until payday, and you really need some money. I mean, really need some money fast. Your friend Lonnie sold you some merchandise, and Lonnie has some very aggressive collection methods. So you certainly want to pay Lonnie off because you want to remain his friend for future purchases. So you go to a quick loan place and you borrow $400 and you write a check that they will cash in 2 weeks. For 2 weeks. Now, they have on their papers, they disclose that they are going to charge you an APR, that's an annual percentage rate, of 19.99%. It's a loan that's quick and dirty and high risk for them. Okay, so now, they're going to say, okay, well, the first thing we're going to do is, since this is for 2 weeks, that would be 2 of 52. So they're going to take the 19.99%, and the way they'll do it is they'll divide by 2 weeks out of 52. That'll be the first thing that they want to do for you, is they're being very generous with you. And you see why it's 2 divided by 52. It's the annual is 19.99%, so they'll take 2 divided by 52 to make it how long this loan will actually last. Okay, let me draw something up here if I can, hoping. I'll pull up a calculator here just so we can do this. Why didn't that work? I could have sworn that was going to work. I want to make it work before I show you guys. Give me a minute here. There it is. Okay. So, okay, well, now clear this out. And we'll take that 19.1999 times 2 divided by 52. There you go. There's the 2 week percentage, 0.768%. And then we'll say, okay. And I'm just going to write this up. That would be 0.7688 6% for 2 weeks. That looks like a very reasonable rate for a couple of weeks. Okay. Certainly. And then we will multiply that times the 400. So the interest they're going to charge you on this loan would be $3.08. That doesn't make sense. Yeah. Yeah, because I have, oh, I'm sorry, times. I wrote a times divide there. You're right. I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay, early morning. Okay, so now we are going to take this times the $400. And we'll get that $3.08 about. So you're going to pay them back $403.08. But it actually is a little bit more than that, because they're going to say to you, okay, we are providing you with this service, so we have a service fee thrown in here of $40. They say 10% of what you borrow, that's our service fee. It's a fee. So the total amount that you will pay them back, the actual amount you write on that check, is $443.08. Okay? That's how much, and then they cash the check in 2 weeks. Okay, let's find out what really is going on. Because you are not paying $3.08 in interest. You are paying $43.08 in interest. So the reality of it is that if I were to take $43.08 divided by $400, I get $443.08. So minus the 400, I'm just running this through on the calculator here, divided by $400 that you actually got. That's 0.10768. Yeah? The $40, it's a fee that they'll charge you based on how much you borrow. This is how these places work. Some charge a flat fee, some charge a percentage of what you get. But remember, it's a fee. Now, that's important for just for in a minute. Okay, that comes out to be 0.1077, which is a 10.77% rate. That is a 2-week rate. If we want to know what that is as an actual annual rate, an effective annual rate, we would take 1 plus 0.1077 to the 1 over the number of years, which is 2/52nds of a year. Remember, 1 over the number of years. In this case, the number of years is 2/52nds of a year. 2 weeks divided by 52 weeks. Remember, it's always 1 over the number of years. Just don't even think about it. It's 1 over the number of years. So the number of years here is 2 divided by 52. Now, if I were to do that, and then, oh, I have to subtract the 1 off. Now, if I were to do that, plus 1 Now raise that to open parenthesis, 1 divided by 2 divided by 52. Close the parenthesis. Close the parenthesis again. Minus 1. Holy Mother of God. 13.28. That's a decimal. That's not a percentage. In order to turn that into a percentage, this is the part that's even, I understand this, it'll take a while to soak in. But the thing that catches you at the end is it looks like a percentage. It's not. That's a decimal. It came out of a mathematic, an arithmetic calculation. So in order to turn that into a percent, I have to multiply by 100. So that's 1328.00. Your actual annual percentage rate on that loan for 2 weeks is 1,328%. That's the actual effective interest rate on the loan. The curiosity I have, and I'll go back to you, madam, since you are causing me difficulties. Is that a reasonable rate? How does that rate strike you? Is that okay? Not okay? You're actually kind of hesitant. You see, there was a time when even saying that you were going to charge an interest rate like that would have been caused you to be taken out into the street. Even before the police could have gotten you for what's called usury, you would have been taken out into the street and shot. This is not normal for another time, but in this time, it doesn't seem to bother anybody that they are paying interest rates of 1,000, 2,000% on these predatory loans. There used to be laws against it. They were called the anti-usury laws that said you can't charge more. And so these places in about 20 years, 25 years ago, I guess it's been, these places were hauled into court because they were in violation of anti-usury laws, which are still on the books. It went clear to the Supreme Court, where the justices said, what are these people who think they're finance people? What are they talking about? The interest rate is 19.99%. There's a fee, but that's not an interest rate. That's just a fee. It says fee, it's a fee. It's not an interest rate. And we politely and respectfully say to the Supreme Court, bullshit! This is usury. This is an interest rate. It doesn't matter what you call it. You can call a pig a cow, but the cow is still going to go, and the pig is going to go, my pig is not as good as my cow, okay? Even my kids told me that. They were very disrespectful of their father. Okay. Especially when I'd say that when their mother was out of the room. Oh. Look, that is an interest rate. And in our time, those don't seem to shock the conscience that this is actually what you are charged. When you are desperate and destitute for money, they can do this to you and it's not illegal. Constitutional law is on their side now. They can call it a fee. They can charge you whatever fee they want. And as long as this still complies with the law, the APR that they disclose, they're in business. They're okay. No one's going to hurt them. No one's going to criticize them for what they're doing. No one's going to prosecute them. But that's what's going on behind the scenes. As a matter of fact, I think I've set up in one of the tests, online tests, you actually do one of these kinds of predatory lender calculations. And the part that catches you real quick, first of all, you have to figure out, okay, since it's 2 of 52 weeks, it's a 2-week loan, you have to take their APR times 2 over 52 to get it to a 2-week rate. But then, once you figured out how much they actually pay, their interest rate on the 2-week rate, that's the interest rate on the 2-week rate, times the 400 that they borrow, you get a very modest, $3.08, that's okay. But then when you add in that fee to what you pay back, you realize that that fee with the $3 that was cheap, the fee which was not cheap, those really are the true amount of interest you pay. Not the $3, but the $3 plus the $40. That's really what you're paying in interest. And then the next part of it, I'm going back through it for you to explain it. Okay, 43 divided by 400 tells me the actual percentage rate, but that is a two-week rate. And then to turn that into an annual rate, I have to do that trick that I showed you in a couple of classes back, where you do 1 plus the interest, periodic interest rate, to the 1 over the number of years. This right here is the number of years. That's the hard part. And then you subtract 1 to turn it back into an interest rate. But the thing is that normally this would come out to be like 0.24, 0.18, 0.07. In this case, it comes out to be a number that already looks like an interest rate, but it isn't. You still have to multiply by 100% to turn it into an interest rate, and that's where Yahtzee happens. You've got the interest rate fully disclosed, and the true interest rate on that loan is a staggering 1,328%. That's just mind-boggling for another time, but in our time, this is the new normal for loans. This also catches us, if you ever get a chance to take some real estate finance classes, one of the things you find out is that when people get mortgage loans, a lot of times they're charged points on the loan. Those points, actually, they're like a percentage of the loan. And it's like one of these fees. And what those points do is they actually cause the true interest rate you're paying on that loan to jump very high. Especially, you'll find that if you, most loans now, mortgage loans, they will let you refinance the loan if interest rates go down after a certain number of years. But what they'll do is they'll say, oh, you can refi with us at a lower rate if rates fall. But in order to do that, you have to pay points during refinancing. Those points oftentimes cause the actual interest rate that you get on refinancing to be worse than the interest rate that you had on your original loan. People don't get that, though. They say, oh, interest rates went down from 6.49% to 4.82%. I'm going to refinance my mortgage loan. Bank says, sure, we'll get all the paperwork together. And then they slip in those points, which makes the balance of your refinancing loan jump. They add those points in, effectively causing the interest rate on your new loan compared to your old loan to be worse. Keep that in mind when you're refining. Look at the fine print. Keep that when you get your original loan. Look at the terms they have for refinancing. Oftentimes, they'll have something in there that'll say, oh, you have to pay these extra points if you refi. And that means that what they're going to do is make it more expensive in the end when you refinance at a lower rate than you had with the higher rate, at least in some circumstances. Enough of that. Show you something here. I'm going to pull up some stock screens here in a minute. Oh, just as a side note, did any of you happen to see, there's been all this news about hackers getting into important systems like Equifax. Pretty much everyone here has now had everything from their social security number to all of their financial history compromised by the hackers who took on Equifax and cracked in. Yesterday, a new disclosure of hackers breaking into a system showed up. They broke into the Edgar system, the one that I've been showing you. They hacked into it. Did any of you see that news? They cracked into Edgar, the SEC, and they're claiming that all the hackers did was read these filings that were private so that they could do insider trading on things that the public hadn't seen yet in these filings. There are these boards that I follow. They're sort of dark boards that are saying, they altered data in the filings. They wouldn't have just gone in there and got, they actually played with the filings, those things that I've been showing you. These hackers have been going on for a long time. We've been screaming our bloody heads off. Stop chasing the idiots on the online who are doing naughty pictures or selling stupid dope. You've got a real problem with hackers that could cause insanely big problems. Here we go again. Busted into the government computer system and compromised the Edgar filings of corporations. So I'm not sure what that means as far as reliability of information goes, but welcome to the new world. Okay, now, I'm going to ask you something. Sir, I want you to tell me how many more years you're going to live. 50? 15. Dude, you have got to lay off that wild stuff, okay? No, seriously, you about 15, yeah. That's good. Madam, how long are you going to live? How many more years?
Probably
16. No, 80. What's your major?
Human resources.
60. Madam, how many years have you got to live? Okay. Actually, you guys are finally getting recognized. For years it was considered one of the black sheep majors. And now all these companies are finally realizing you guys are like the center of so many things that happen in the company. I just had last year, one of my students, she followed me in a couple of courses. She was an HR major. She got a job for $64,000 a year salary. That's just mind-boggling compared to what you guys were getting even 5 years ago in the upper 30s. So you're good. You're good. How long?
I think it was 70.
70. What's your major?
Business management.
Maybe. Okay. Here's the thing, though. You all know you're going to die. Fortunately, you aren't under the impression that you're going to live forever. That's a good thing. That's the first step to growing up, is realizing that you're going to die. And then as time goes on, you encounter incidents to convince you, yep, I'm going to die, possibly now. But remember the distinction. With corporations, there is no theoretical limit on how long they can live. They live forever. Unless something bad happens, they go into bankruptcy, or they are taken over and the original corporation is completely eviscerated, wiped out. But there is not a time limit on them. We all have a clock in us. Mine is ticking rather rapidly now, and it's very annoying because it's loud, especially in the morning. But the thing that has a use to us in finance, the fact that corporations theoretically live forever, because we can use that assumption and be somewhat reasonable in that assumption about cash flows of the corporation. Specifically, for a corporation, remember I told you about a kind of annuity that lasts forever, the perpetuity? Perpetuities are annuities that have an infinite stream of cash flows. It goes on, an eternal, I should say. They go on forever. Now, that might seem like something that is completely unreasonable, but it is not. There are a couple of places where we can actually say this is a good formula. And actually, we can price stock using the formula for a perpetuity, which is actually, it's so easy, you wouldn't want to use the finance app on the calculator. You can just do it as an arithmetic calculation. The present value of a level perpetuity Now that means that the cash flow is the same every year, forever and ever, is just that cash flow value amount divided by the discount rate that you use for this security. It's simple. Now, this would be a market discount rate. It would be what the market would assess the risk of this cash flow is. The first place we can find this is in stock prices. But specifically, there are a lot of different ways I can divide up equity. And I'll talk a little about those in a minute here. But first things first, the one most people think of is what is called common stock. That's the one almost everyone thinks of when they hear the stock price. But there's another kind of equity called preferred stock. It used to be awfully popular, but interestingly enough, in modern times, you don't see it as much, except in certain types of industries. Now, a company can raise money by selling common stock, $10 a share for 1 million shares, they raise $10 million. But they could also sell preferred stock. And the two are quite kind of different. They're both equity. They're not debt. They're both equity. Be careful about saying something like that on an exam. But the thing with preferred stock is that it has the right to dividends before common stock does. Again, preferred stock has the right to dividends before common stock. And the preferred stock dividend is written right on the certificate. What you're going to get every year forever. It's written right. See, with common stock, you don't even know if you're going to get a dividend. You don't know what it's going to be from one period to the next and all that. With preferred stock, it is a defined dividend. And it gets its dividend before the common stock. In fact, there is some preferred stock that's called cumulative. If I miss a dividend payment to you, Mr. Preferred Stock Shareholder, I miss a couple, before I can give you, Mr. Common Stock Holder, a dividend, I have to catch up all my dividends with you. That's called cumulative preferred. In other words, I can't do anything for you common stock holders unless I am up to date and caught up with you cumulative preferred holders. This makes preferred stock kind of like a nice deal for certain types of portfolios. See, bonds are safer than stock. Know that. Because the bonds get paid before stock gets anything. But in terms of preferred stock, if I've got a retired couple, what I might do, you come to me in your golden years, you've got a couple which are, they're very far away. I mean, God, that hate look. They are very far away. Easy. Okay. What you could do is you say, I've got $10 million. Now, I want to invest that safely, and I want she and her partner are going to want a cash flow stream. They're not going to want to take a lot of risk. I could do bonds with you because their coupons come in, but I could also do preferred stock because I know the dividend is defined. I don't even have to worry about that. And it will just keep streaming forever and ever and ever to you. And you can endow it or give it to your in estate to your children, and they'll have those that cash flow forever. That's a nice thing, is because with bonds, they always mature, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. But with preferred stock, the dividend would go on forever. It is a perpetuity. And it is a classic level perpetuity because the actual amount of money is defined on the stock certificate itself. Sort of the language. TVL, cumulative 1.5% preferred par value $40 per share. Now, the first would be the ticker symbol of it. Then the cumulative would say this is the kind of preferred, the special kind of preferred, where if TVL doesn't pay the preferred dividend, it has to accumulate them and catch them up before it can pay the common shareholders anything. And this one, par value, will always be part of the statement because the dividend is a percent of the par value. So there will be those two critical things. There will be the dividend as a percent and then the par value of the preferred, in this case, $40. And then you'd say, oh, well, that means that each share of TVL cumulative preferred that I own, I will get $0.42. Is that 1% is $0.40, and 40 cents and 2 cents. I think that's 42 cents. Is it? I am so bad at arithmetic anymore. These calculators have killed me. Let me just make sure. 0.0115 times 40. Six. Wait, what? 60 cents. My bad. Wow. 60 cents. Okay. So, in other words, this, if I own, let's say, 100,000 shares of TVL cumulative, 100,000 shares, I would get per share 60 cents a year forever. Forever. That's a level of perpetuity. Okay, so now the next thing. This formula, that R right there, that you divide by CF over R, that is not that 1.5%. It might be, but the R is actually the market's assessment of the risk. The 1.5 was the original assessment of risk the company created when it sold the stock, designed and sold the stock. But the market might pull this up 1.6%, down 1.4%. That is just, this R is the market's assessment in a given period of time. So in other words, watch this. Suppose that market risk is 1.5%, the same as the coupon. Then the price value of this stock would be 60 cents per share over 0.015. If the market's risk assessment is the same as the original dividend assessment, then I would take just 0.015 and I'd get the par value. In other words, if the market's risk is the same as the dividend, this thing is selling at par. You would see $40 a share on the ticker symbol for the stock. Let's say that the market's assessment of the risk was lower than the dividend. Well, this dividend would be rich. And in that case, the price of the TVL preferred would be 60 cents per share over 0.012. which would come out to be 0.6 divided by 0.012, it'd sell at $50 a share. In other words, this stock would sell at a premium. Investors would like this because they think it really should pay 1.2% and it pays 1.5%. Notice that this thing looks suspiciously like what we did with bonds. And you'll see more about that in a little bit. But suppose that the market says, this thing is getting We think this preferred is a little riskier than 1.5%. Let's say that the market thinks that the risk level is 1.8%. In that case, the perpetuity formula would come out with 0.60 over 0.018. And in that case, 0.6 over divided by 0.018, $33.33. So in this case, the preferred stock would sell at a discount to par. In other words, the price after issue, the price of preferred stock will fluctuate based upon the interest rate environment. The one thing that you can be pretty sure, though, is that preferred behaves like bonds. It's not going to swing wildly. Preferred stock tends to stay around its par value, up and down somewhat. This is a little bit wild for preferred stock, what I did here. I just did it to magnify it. Normally, the risk rate, the market's assessment of risk will float, maybe 10 basis points around the dividend. But again, you can see that this is actually very good, a good investment component in the portfolio of an older couple or a mature corporation that doesn't want to put a lot of risk on their investments in securities. Now, as I said, oddly enough, this preferred stock used to be quite popular back in the day. Oddly enough, over the past 20 years, it has lost a lot of its luster. You don't see a lot of companies issuing preferred stock anymore. You might see some on their books of corporations, old corporations, but that was when they issued it long ago. I took my students up to a portfolio construction house in Chicagoland. And what they do there is they put together different portfolios, and their products, stocks, bonds, stuff like that, in different arrangements for different risk profiles. And then they get brokers, stockbrokers, to sell these products to the broker's clients. So in other words, if you came to me, a broker, and you said, I've got this money, I want to invest it. What I might do, matter of fact, I probably would do, is I would go to you, one of these portfolio construction companies, and say, what do you got? And, we got this product. What do you got that's lower risk but still has some capital gains in it, et cetera? Or maybe, this is a risk taker and wants to see some real high gains, doesn't really care about dividends. You got different products. And I would take one of these products and I would convince you that I worked really hard on your behalf. I had worked out a portfolio in my mind. And you'd say, you deserve a big commission. And what I don't tell you is, this was just a product I bought. And what I do is I share the commission with you. That's how it works in a lot of places. So this company, we were up there, and what happened? They were showing all kinds of things. They were saying, if you're kind of interested in numbers and all this kind of stuff, we look at all these stocks and bonds, and we create all these different kinds of portfolios that do different tricks. And the interesting thing was they said, we have a new kind of line of products. And this was about 4 years ago. We got a new line of products. What they do is they actually produce a high dividend yield. So what we do is we put together products that have almost no capital gain prospect, but they have all their flow comes through a pretty certain dividend. So there's almost in the product, you get this product, what would happen is you would be able to get a check every year or every 6 months or every 3 months, a dividend check. But you wouldn't see the portfolio's value rise very much. And I couldn't help myself. I said, Why are you doing that? Why wouldn't you just put together a portfolio of preferred stock? That's exactly what preferred stock, you're not going to get capital gains on it. It's not going to jump way up in price. It's going to float around a price, but you're going to get a guaranteed dividend. And yet here was this portfolio construction company building portfolios that pretended to do the same thing that preferred stock did. I said, why don't you just put preferred stock into it? No capital gain or hardly any capital gain, almost guaranteed dividend of the same amount every year forever and ever and ever. Well, you know, no one uses preferred stock anymore. Why not? Well, it's just old-fashioned. We got to work for our money. In other words, you're going to do all that work, and there's a product out there that already does what you're doing all this fancy analytics to get. You see, what I'm trying to say here is that there is a kind of stock that you're not going to earn capital gains. It's not going to skyrocket in value. It's going to float around the same value forever. And at the same time, though, you're going to get a guaranteed, or a pretty much guaranteed, as long as the company's able to do it, dividend. The same amount of money every year. You go to your mailbox every year. Oh, goody, I can pay my bills. Anyway, that's preferred stock. A nice little, just something to keep in mind. Now, if you're looking for preferred stock, if you want to put some in your portfolio, or if you want to recommend it to your elderly grandparents or your parents, you could say, not to your parents or elderly, where I'm seeing preferred stock showing up these days, most of the ticker symbols that I'm seeing for preferred are real estate companies. REITs, REITs, real estate investment trusts, other kinds of real estate investment companies. They seem to be the ones where all the ticker symbols cluster that are preferred ticker symbols. It's a P dot, or a dot P is what you would look for a preferred. I was going to pull one up, but actually finding preferred kind of drives me crazy. Almost wanted to show you because there. It used to be I could find them all the time. 20 years ago, when I was doing a class like this, I could have just pulled up. There would be best stocks for the day, and you'd have a lot of common stocks, but you'd have preferred stocks in there. These days, you ain't gonna find it. And matter of fact, it's actually getting harder and harder to find lots of stock quotes at the same time. We have some terminals downstairs. Morningstar terminals and stuff like that, but real quick, Wall Street Journal sometimes has a decent. Best performing stocks. I'll see if Wall Street Journal comes up on this. No, it's not going to do it. I'm not going to waste a lot of time on this. Stock prices today. Yeah, you get these ads. Stay away from stock data. Now, it's actually a lot more difficult these days just to get a nice show of different stocks, you know, the best performers and all of that. It's not as easy as it used to be, so I'm not going to work hard on that. Oh, stock prices. Yesterday, winners and losers. I mean, you know, you can look at those. It's stock news, stock market today, the Dow, Russell, stock prices, center, meh. It's going to be too hard to find anything that's a good way to look for it. You can't search this way. Anyway, enough of that. Next thing, though. There is a variation on the formula for a perpetuity that allows us to extend the ability to price See, what I did here is I actually priced a stock. And I'll show you different ways that you can price stocks and then look to see if the price that is being reflected is the same as what you've done to see some idea, is there a buy here? If I calculate a price that maybe is about 20 cents better or than what I'm seeing, that might be a buy signal. But don't do that yet. But anyway, what I did here was I priced a type of stock. It's an unusual kind of stock, but I've actually taken a math formula and turned it into a practical application. Okay. There's a way to, there's a variation on this formula that allows us to price a stock that has a constant growth of the dividend. It works like this. That was the level perpetuity. The next one is the constant growth perpetuity. Now this one, by the way, I'm going to strike this out, the CF up here, and I'm going to replace it with a D, the dividend, just for notational convenience, okay, the dividend. I mean, you can use it for things other than stocks, but for the present, we just say cash flow is dividend. So the constant growth perpetuity works like this, the formula. It is the dividend at period, the price of constant growth dividend stock is the dividend divided by the market's risk rate minus the growth rate of the dividend. Here's where you have to watch yourself. This formula requires that you use the dividend one period out. So if you're given the current dividend, you have to grow that one period. That, in other words, the dividend one period out is one plus the growth rate of the current dividend. Watch that. Don't be tricked. I see the dividend. I put that in the numerator. No. See if that is the current dividend or if that is the dividend projected 1 year out. If it's the current dividend, you've got to grow it one period by doing the current dividend times 1 plus G. If it's already, well, the stock will pay next year this dividend, then that's already D1. Just watch that. It's a trap that you can fall into. Some of the questions in the in your current homework quiz and test will tell you. I think one, okay, it's been about a couple of weeks since I looked at it. I think one of them tells you the dividend next year will be. In that case, it's already D1. But if they said, well, the current dividend is. Now, I'm going to show you what you can use this formula to do. Let me pull up a screen here. Real quick here. I'm going to finance. Well, let me check here just to make sure. Okay. Okay. Let me, okay. Now, let me do something real quick here and then I'll bring the screen back up. Okay. Now what I'm going to do here, I'm going to pull up Microsoft and show you how this would be done. Now, this is going to be real back of the envelope. Real back of the envelope. But it should come out with something that's not way out there. Because I grabbed one right off the top of my head just to show you how I would do this without a lot of prior knowledge about what's going on. Okay, now, we've got the price of Microsoft. Let's ignore that for a second. And let's say that that price is being formed by the dividend projection one period out divided by the market's assessment of risk minus the growth rate of the stock dividends. Okay? So to put this into practice, I'm going to pull these and I'll show you how you can do this later. But I'm going to suppose that the market's assessment of the risk of Microsoft right now is about 7%. Now, I'll show you, right now I'm pulling it out of the air, but I'll show you how we do this in a couple of lectures. It's called the capital asset pricing model. It's not hard at all. It's just a real simple arithmetic formula. Now, I am going to say that the growth rate Microsoft has for its dividends is about 5%. Now, I want to say something about that right now. The market, if you start paying a dividend, the market is going to want you to keep paying that dividend. If you start giving your investors candy, they're going to be at your door every year for more of your candy, okay? So the one thing is, if you start paying a dividend, you're in the program. The next thing is that they are going to want that dividend to grow over time. And if sometimes I'll do this in a class, I won't do it for this one, but I'll show you. Many companies have a constant growth rate dividend policy. You go year to year to year, and you'll see that the dividend is growing at about the same rate 1 year over the next, over the next. That is why this growth rate formula isn't so simple, isn't so unrealistic. Many companies try to keep a constant growth rate on their dividends. I've seen, I can't remember what it was, a couple of years ago, I did one. I showed in the Edgar filing statements, back when they had 5 years of data, I showed the dividend year to year to year. Sure enough, every year the thing was growing at 2.5%, like clockwork, every year, 2.5%. So this growth rate of the dividend is very much realistic. The 7%, I don't know yet. But if I look up here at the stock screens, the dividend is $1.56. That is the current. That's D0. That's what's now. Okay, so in order for us to make this formula work, the price would be that $1.56 grown 1 year at 5% times 1 plus 0.05, all divided by 0.07 minus 0.05. Now, let's see if I get anywhere close to the price of this stock doing this. We'll see. Probably going to be off by a mile, but because I thought Microsoft was around 7% discount rate, but I don't know. But if I do, 1.56 times 1 plus 0.05. In other words, to get D1, that's what I just did up here. It's I got the dividend one period out, knowing the dividend now and the growth rate, divided by, now I'm going to open parentheses, 0.07 minus 0.05. Survey says, spank me. That wasn't bad. The actual one, if I'm not mistaken, it is a little bit, it's a little bit steeper than 7%. If I remember right, it was like 7.2%, something like that. I think that was the major thing that happened here. But you can see, I'm in the ballpark. The formula, if you use the right numbers, it's garbage in, garbage out. If you use the right numbers, you can dead on hit stock prices. As long, and here's the thing though. One, you have to have a company that's paying a dividend. These younger companies that don't pay dividends, you got to do some pretty fancy calculations to get a price for those. The other thing is that you have to have that discount rate, but also this company has to be stable enough that it has a constant growth rate of its dividend. Sometimes companies, they start paying a dividend and it has like turbulence. It's almost like an engine just starting. But eventually they get to the point, maybe 2-5 years, something like that. You see them stabilize to a constant growth rate of the dividend. It's kind of hard to tell when a company is going to do this. But my experience has been, once a company starts paying a dividend, it's got people in there who say, we got to stabilize the growth of this dividend. Well, can't we just pay the same dividend next year? Look at what happens here. In the formula, if growth rate is zero, the higher the growth rate, the smaller R minus G. The bigger G is, all other things being constant, the smaller R minus G is. So as a denominator, that makes the whole thing bigger. So the faster the growth rate of the dividend, the higher the price of the stock, all other things being equal. Again, let me say that again. As this G goes up, R minus G goes down. And so as a denominator, that makes D1 over R minus G go up. So the faster the growth rate of the dividend, the higher the price of the stock will be. That makes sense. Fast dividend growth rate would equate to more of a better stock price. So notice this, that dividend policy and the price of the stock are actually related. Remember I told you the more they give to the stockholders as dividend, the less they can plow back into the company. And so the less the stock price will go up. However, the faster the growth rate of the dividend, the faster the capital gains are realized by investors. So it's kind of a two-edged sword. It really bothers me when I see a company giving out too much in dividends to its shareholders, because that means it's not reinvesting to grow the stock price. But at the same time, if they start with modest dividends, not trying to give all the candy in the world, they give modest dividends to their investors, to their stockholders. But at the same time, they aggressively grow that dividend. That is actually good for the stock price. So in other words, some company that starts out, okay, we're going to start our first dividend at 50 cents a share, okay? I'm a company official, and you say 50 cents a share, well, that's nice. I'm going to get a 50 cent check, but your earnings per share are 75 cents. You've got only 25 cents of plowback into the company. That means my stock price isn't going to go up because you have hardly any money to reinvest. If I said, okay, I'm going to give you each 1 penny dividend. Well, you're going to be rather miffed at me. A penny? Gee whiz, let me go out and buy dinner at Denny's. Grand Slam. It's not bad. They've got a new Grand Slam sandwich. I actually almost got one before class today, but I thought I'd be burping in class, and everyone gets so annoyed when I do that. But you see, but I'm going to grow that dividend at 10% a year. Then R minus G is a R minus a 0.1, which makes that denominator smaller. Go. Well, it would depend. I'd say I'm going to grow the dividend at 50 cents, and I'll grow it at 2% a year. No, it's 2% of every year. It's a compounding phenomenon, which is nasty. But if I say 50 cents a year and I'll grow the dividend 2% a year, That's not good for the stock. I would worry, especially if EPS is like 75 cents a share. But if I said a penny a share, but I'm going to grow this dividend at 10, 15% a year, that would actually cause the stock price to pop. Because I'm not bleeding earnings into dividends. I'm still plowing a lot back into the company. And I'm driving the stock price up because I'm promising the investors that you're going to get 10% more every year on your dividend check. And over time, that's going to accumulate to a nice dividend when our company is mature, but it's not going to bleed us off now for needed internally generated equity dollars. So that's sort of the playoff here in this constant growth perpetuity formula. Now, I want to show you one last thing here, and I honestly can't recall whether I showed this to you in the last lecture. Let me get all this off the board. Today, as I said, these are practical things to do, useful things. But let me get back to something really, really practical here that I had shown you the last time. And it has to do with calculating loan payments and all of that. I'll turn this off so you can see the calculator. I know it's more difficult there in the back to see this calculator. Now, I did one with you, showed you how to get your loan payments. 30-year... fixed rate mortgage, APR, 5.89%. Loan value, let's say $175,000. Now, the first thing is, again, just to refresh your memory, how you do this on your calculator. This is a classic level, ordinary annuity. And it's one of those things that's practical for years after you've been out of this class. For some of you, a lot of this will be relevant. For others of you, you'll try to purge this stuff as fast as you can. That's cool. But some of this, like this, is something that's practical for the rest of your life almost. Like the I'm going to figure out the payments on this loan. Apps, finance, TVM solver. And this is just what we did before. 30 years times monthly payments, 12. So there's going to be 360 periods. Your I percent, 5.89 divided by 12 months per year. Your price value. And don't forget this. It's been this way ever since financial calculators have been around. And they've been around 40 years almost now. But you always put in a present value as a negative. PV, negative 175. And there's no kicker. Now, by the way, you're going to run into a problem or two in the homework quiz and test where you have a lease, where you can buy the car at the end of the lease. That means you put in an FV, which is the buyout price of the lease. But this one isn't like that. Payment, I guess now I can just do the alpha solve. $1,036.87 a month. Sort of sobering to see how much a payment on a house would be. And if you've got a 25% credit threshold, how much you'd have to make a month to have a decent house. $175 gets you a nice house. Not a gorgeous house, but at least it's not a house trailer. Okay, now, here's the thing that I want to give you to show you. Now, let's go out of this, and I'm going to show you something. I did second quit. Now I'm going to go apps, finance. And I'm going to go way down here on this list of things that you can do. See this Sigma PRN? Now, if I hit that one's number zero, Sigma PRN. And I key in, okay, what's going to be my balance on this loan in 8 years? Because I think I'd probably want to flip this house in 8 years. Well, 8 years would be 8 times 12. Really? I can't do that. 96. I think I can just do it this way. Yeah, I thought there was a problem with that. I have to do it 86, 86. Close the parenthesis. Oh, 96, sorry. 96, close the parenthesis. On the principal, my payments would be the 1,036. I would be paying $283 on the next payment on principal. Now go back in apps, finance. I can go down here to, I think balance will do it. Balance. At 96, and I think I need to put in the 96 only once. The balance after 8 years will be $153,000. Okay, that's the one that I wanted to show you, was the balance thing. Because this way I can actually profile the amortization of the loan. At 8 years, in other words, in 96 months, I will have, if the house held its equity, if it held its value at 175, I could actually do plus $175,000. And I'd have about $21,750 in equity in the house. So that would tell me that as long as the value stayed at $175,000, I didn't have a bust in the real estate market, I'd have that much equity. And so if I sold the house for $175,000, then I'd have almost $22,000 as a down payment on an upgrade house. Let's say that I held the house for 12 years. Apps, finance, balance. 12 years times 12, that'd be 144 months out. The balance would be $137,803. I think that's what that says. So if I were able to sell it at 175 12 years later, my equity at that point in the house would be $37,116. So this allows you to create in advance a profile of how fast and how much equity you're building year over year or month over month, which gives you an idea of, for future planning, holding the value of your house and planning for your next house. Just some practical use of this stuff. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.